The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's a Europod. Hey Liga, Atleti have the advantage after the top four played each other and nobody won. A Wilson scenario variant in the Real Sevilla game with a penalty at each end at the same time. In France, PSG might end up winning nothing. Lille just 4 points away from winning the title with a 35-year-old banging in 30-yarders. While Poch's men get frustrated and then kick everybody. I'm sure I've seen that before. It's Inter's title in Italy where the big story is whether Juventus will even get into the Champions League so they can be thrown out of the Champions League for clinging on to the ESL. And there's no Archie today, so in episode one, in almost certainly a series of one, it's Barry's Bundesliga Bulletin. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Sid Lowe, hello.
Hi Max, how are you?
I am really well, thanks very much. Hello Nikki Randini.
Morning Max, how are you again?
I am still... I didn't even ask you how you were. I don't care, Nikki. I do apologise. Harry says, every time that Philippe is on the pod, I hope Max learns how to say, yeah, marvellous, in French. Maybe this is the one. Oui, merveilleux.
Ouais, pas mal.
Ah.
Bonjour, Max. Ça va? Oui? Oui, merveilleux?
I thought it was better than pas mal, to be honest, but you know.
Yeah, you would say normally, if somebody asks, ça va? C'est... Ouais, super.
Super. Barry, ça va?
Guten Tag.
Oh, there we are. It's Daniel Day-Lewis. Blimey. He's been like this for 24 hours. He's in character.
I'm wearing lederhosen. Yeah, okay, drinking good. A large stein of beer.
Of course you are. Right, let's start in Spain then. So the top four played each other in what could have been a super exciting weekend, Sid. Was it a super exciting weekend?
Well, it was. Because anything that happens when it's that tight feels massive. And yet we've had one of these very strange league title races, certainly over the last 4 or 5 weeks, where it feels like everything's a turning point, but it just turns you back to where you were. And every decisive moment then ends up not deciding anything. But I suppose by definition it is decisive, because if it doesn't go that way, then it would have decided something. I realise that I'm now tying myself in knots, but that's kind of how it is. And of course it comes down to that moment in the Real Madrid game where basically there is a penalty at both ends, two penalties 15 seconds apart, and it's up to the referee to decide which of the two penalties he gives. Does he give the penalty to Real Madrid? Does he give the penalty to Sevilla? The penalty to Real Madrid would decide the league title, although as we've already established, nothing's really deciding anything right now. The penalty to Sevilla might decide the league title back again. The long and short of it is the top four played each other and they're in the same positions. As they were at the start of the weekend, except that they're kind of not, are they? Because they're in the same positions with a game fewer to play each, and having now gone through that weekend in which winning or not losing was either an obligation or an opportunity. So you've still got Atletico Madrid top by 2 points. You've still got Real Madrid and Barcelona level on points, but Madrid top on the head-to-head difference. And in truth, we've now got Sevilla out of the race. But it was pretty exciting. Two draws, a 0-0 and a 2-2. The 2-2 was certainly the better game.
The penalty at each end is the most fun part of it. It happened in the Nations League final, I remember, at Switzerland and Portugal, I think, when I was there.
Oh, it has happened before, right. Okay, I didn't know if it had ever happened before.
And it was similar. It was a sort of soft hand ball at one end and a definite foul at the other. So, I was in the ground and obviously... didn't really know what was going on and was finding it tremendously entertaining at the same time, because obviously just seeing the players claiming for a penalty and then sort of trying to tell the referee not to go to the screen, don't bother going to, you don't want to look at that. You've made a great decision here. And I don't know if it was the same in this game.
There was very definitely a pantomime element to it. And so this was slightly different, and this was different to a lot of VAR handballs that I've been in the ground for this year, because to be perfectly honest, when you're in the stadium and there is a VAR handball given, you normally have no idea. The first thing you know is that the referee's going to look at the screen, and you have no idea what he's looking at. You can only guess that because the ball's dropped in the area, someone somewhere has either tugged at a shirt or handballed it. This actually was a clear enough handball, and we can argue about whether you think it should be given or not, but in terms of the position of the arm and so on, it was a clear enough handball that we had actually seen it. And there was a big shout. We heard a few people shout, you know, Mano! And then Madrid break from the edge of the area, and I'm one of those sad people who times these things, from the first handball to the second penalty, in other words, from one penalty to the other, 15 seconds passed. That's all it was. So the ball breaks on the edge of that area. And for some reason, Sevilla are suddenly wide open as if it's the 96th minute and they're throwing everyone forward. I mean, Benzema is genuinely running through on his own from the halfway line, runs through, gets taken down, penalty. That one definitely is. And of course, at that point, as I say, it's a bit different to most VAR decisions because you know that there is something there. It's not that, you know, there's a goal and suddenly it's ruled out. And you know that he's going to have to go to the VAR screen. He pauses after the second penalty, as he would do anyway. And everybody's waiting. And then, as you say, there's this moment of advice. Now, there's not very many people in the grounds at the moment, but there's probably maybe 300, 250, 300 people in the grounds. And you get the referee go to the VAR screen. And of course, in terms of pressure, you are one man. And the fate of the league title is in your hands. And I was thinking about this on Sunday. And I was thinking about this like those old You Are the Referee kind of cartoons. You are the ref. The fate of the league title is in your hands. What do you do? A, shit yourself. B, run away and hide. C, retire right now. Or D, as was always the case in You Are the Ref, restart with a drop ball. And he's standing at the VAR screen. And the stand, the other thing about this is because, obviously, as Jurgen Klopp pointed out, Valdebebas is part of Real Madrid's training ground. It's actually a mini stadium, but it is mini. So the players are very, very close to him. You've got the players and the staff and the coaching staff and all the substitutes standing up, shouting at the referee. It was behind him. He couldn't see anything. He didn't even know where it was. Look at the foul. Look at the handball. There was a real kind of, oh, yes, it is. Oh, no, it isn't about it. And everyone's shouting and putting pressure on him. And this referee is standing on his own in front of a screen. The whole world hates him. He knows that he's screwed no matter what he decides. And actually, he didn't look at the screen for very long. And I think he didn't look at the screen for very long. And I'm sure there will be some Real Madrid fans who disagree with this because actually the handball's fairly clear. And so he wasn't there for as long as I thought he might be. But it was really amazing watching this unfold. Everyone standing and shouting advice at him and saying, which bits of this matter? No, no, it took a deflection. And no, no, he's facing the other way. And ref, but what about this? And no, there was a tug on the shirt. And everybody's kind of shouting different bits of advice. And by the way, it's worth pointing out here, all of these people shouting this advice, when they have absolutely no idea, they haven't got a replay in front of them. You know, they're in the stands. They're shouting what they hope they've seen and what they hope the referee will see on the screen. And then, of course, you get those moments when the players come towards him. And he's like, go away. I'm watching the telly. He's like a teenager. Leave me alone. I'm watching the telly. And he actually turns around at one point and says, what do you want? A yellow card? And everyone's kind of looking at him. Anyway, eventually he gives the penalty. And in all of this, I feel like I should kind of point out that the nerves and the sort of, I mean, I know this shouldn't be brave because this is a referee's job, but the nerve for the referee, you know, the pressure he's under. And then the pressure Ivan Rakitic is under, who's had to wait a long time for this and knows how big it is. I suppose part of the pressure is gone because once you've given the penalty to Sevilla, even if he misses, you're not then giving the penalty to Madrid at the other end. So it's not a goal or a goal, it's a goal or nothing. Anyway, he scores and then Real Madrid do get a late equaliser, which I must admit, in the course of the game, because it felt all the way through like Madrid have to win this. When Madrid scored an equaliser in, what was it, 93 and a half minutes, I kind of didn't appreciate how important it was. But actually, when the dust settles, you look at it and think, wow, that late goal from Toni Kroos is potentially still quite huge, even though Madrid didn't go top.
A late goal by Toni Kroos that flicked potentially.
Oh, yeah, it's Hazard, isn't it? Yeah, not Kroos's, you know,
Is that salvation that Eden Hazard needed just to be standing in the way of a Toni Kroos shot to deflect it in? Does that mean that they haven't done any more sort of moody late-night chat shows about him?
Well, that certainly wasn't a goal that everyone was clinging to and saying he was a genius. But it will help if they do go on and win the league. I must admit, by the way, in the ground, I had absolutely no idea that it touched Hazard. And it was right in front of me. But I could see that he'd taken a deflection, but I thought it was the defender. I didn't realise it was Hazard.
That basically means that Atleti are top 77 from 35. They've all played 35, 77. Mm-hmm. Real Madrid and Barcelona have 75 each and Sevilla 71. So we can kind of discount Sevilla now. I guess they had to win that game. Barcelona and Atleti drew 0-0. What did you make of that game?
There's a couple of things. One is that I thought Atletico played very well for the first half and did take the game to Barcelona. And one of the accusations made, obviously, of Simeone and of Atletico is that they sit too deep too often. I don't think they did in this game. I think the other kind of conclusion, I suppose, you would take from it is that Messi apart, Barcelona did too little. And it was striking to see this in a game in which, you know, potentially this is the league title at stake. And it felt like there wasn't the urgency, there wasn't the immediacy, the kind of speed that you want from Barcelona, whether it's in circulation of the ball or trying to release people. There was a little bit more in the second half and they came close a couple of times. There's a very good chance for Dembélé and there's a messy free kick that goes just wide right at the very, very end. But you look at it in the context of Barcelona's big games this season and they really haven't responded in the biggest games. You know, their record against Atletico and Real Madrid is 3 defeats and a draw. That's why if they finish level with Real Madrid, they would lose the league. And this is another reason, by the way, why Toni Kroos' goal is important. Because Toni Kroos' goal, even though Madrid lost the chance to go top, puts them back ahead of Barcelona and means that now, if Atletico Madrid so much as draw one of their final games, it goes back into Real Madrid's hands. But the Atletico-Barca game was a bit disappointing, I think, considering what was in play.
I thought it was all right for a scoreless draw, Sid. Yeah. Messi... Almost scored one of those goals, which if Messi had scored it, we'd all be talking about it for months.
It was brilliant, wouldn't it? It would have been, I think, probably the goal of the season. It was a completely brilliant run from nowhere. And it does feel now like Barcelona will probably fall short, as I say, because they've got two teams they've got to overcome. Even though it's only 2 points, it's difficult to imagine that they overcome two teams to win the league.
Sid, I was just curious about Joao Felix and where he's sort of at, because he obviously came off the bench in this game. Feels like he's really declined very rapidly in the last part of this season, particularly maybe, but certainly his trajectory over the time at Atletico from being this record signing to being someone who, I don't know, is he even going to be part of the Portugal team this summer? I don't know. It feels like his star's really fallen a long way at this point.
Yeah, I don't know what Portugal's feelings on this will be, because whether he has a kind of a steady place within the way that they set up. At Atletico Madrid, he started really, really well. And there was a feeling that they got the best out of him. This being his second season, he would now really step on, and that Simeone had found a structure that worked for him. And in that first half of the season, we were watching an Atletico Madrid team that wanted more of the ball, that were playing up the pitch, and that seemed to suit him. But his performances haven't been great. I think there is... I think underlining it, there's I suppose there's a suspicion that everybody has, which is maybe he's just not a Simeone player, and maybe that's part of the breakdown. But I actually think in defence of Simeone, how long do you keep playing someone who sort of a lot of the time doesn't look that bothered? Which I think is probably just body language. I don't think it's entirely fair. I think we too easily grab onto that kind of image of people. But his performances haven't been great. And I think Simeone at times has preferred Angel Correa, who's very, very erratic, but a little bit more electric. His position is a very difficult one. The problem from Atletico Madrid's point of view, which I think happens to a lot of clubs when there's a really big player who isn't performing, is given the way the market's likely to be, if you were to look for an exit strategy, you certainly don't get the €126 million back.
Has that answered your question, Philippe?
It has kind of answered my question, because I was wondering, you know, given that very much Atletico are of this this kind of, they know how to buy and they know how to sell very well. How do they justify today, you know, such a purchase? I mean, what was in their mind when they, did they really think they could turn him into a €250 million player when they bought him? Or is it a bit more complicated and opaque than that?
I suspect it's a bit more complicated and at the same time more simple. And I suspect it has two words that help to define it. And those two words are Jorge Mendes. I think that part of it is the closeness of the relationship with Mendes. I think part of it is that the way that he will have worked, I suspect, with Atletico Madrid will be effectively a promise that, you know, in any case, I will make sure there's a market for him. In any case, I will make sure that this works out and that you'll be protected. This is a very exciting player. There's no doubt about it. This is someone who, in theory, at least, could have become really big for Atletico. I think you also need to look at it in the context of the moment that it was, in that essentially, while the money was huge, this is the summer in which Griezmann goes to Barcelona. So the money is huge, but the money is also there. So, to use that old phrase, the net spend is zero. So in a way, it's swapping one for another.
What we're talking about, a lot of money, you know, reading reports about Kane and Haaland repeatedly going somewhere. And, you know, the latest one I saw the other day, you know, Kane happy to go to Barcelona. And obviously that ties into the ESL and whether these clubs have any money. Like, you know, can you see a way that Real Madrid or Barcelona would be spending a huge amount of money on a footballer this summer?
The way I can see Barcelona and Real Madrid spending a huge amount of money is investment funds. That's the only way that, you know, huge loans from investment funds. Because, I mean, Florentino Perez, obviously, the if you like, the kind of the lasting message of that whole Super League mess was, we're in trouble here. You know, in theory, they were supposed to be selling this idea of power and these are big clubs and this is where the future lies. But actually what really shone through in that first interview that Florentino Perez did with El Chiringuito was just how bad the situation was. Now, in part, he might have been hamming it up to try and impress upon everyone the need of doing this. But it really did reveal that. And then there was an interview, I think it was the one that he did on a Cadena Ser, and he was asked about Mbappe and Haaland and so on. He said, look, there won't be signings like this if there's no Super League. And then about 3 or 4 minutes later, they said, so you're not buying Mbappe then? And he said, I didn't say that.
Well, maybe he still believes there will be one, you know?
Yeah. And so I think, look, Real Madrid believe that they can get Mbappe. Whether it's now or later, they believe that he will be a Real Madrid player. But of course, as you say, how do you pay for it? And the sales are not happening. So we saw this last year with Barcelona trying to sell Coutinho. We saw it with Real Madrid trying to sell James and Bale and not being able to. So you can't generate the money that you think you can generate. And so I think what we will see is investment funds.
Sid, going to investment funds, that's okay if, for example, you're Liverpool and you go to Redbird and you give them a part of the shareholding. But you can't do that when you're Real Madrid and Barcelona. Or you would have to change the status of the clubs. So which means that you're going to have to accept loans at interest rates of something like 12, 15%.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
Exactly. That's it. These loans cannot be given against shareholding in the club. They can be given on particular conditions. And those conditions will involve guarantees of repayment. They will involve guarantees perhaps of player sales and cuts of player sales if and when they happen. As you say, they will involve interest rates that are higher. But then I guess that's the nature of loaning. I mean, that's the nature of going to get money at a time when traditional avenues are not always open. Now, for what it's worth, I think for clubs the size of Real Madrid and Barcelona, they will find banks that are willing to do so as well.
Carl says, thoughts on Valencia's fans' huge protest against their owner, Peter Lim, an owner who, Carl says, admits only owns the club as a status symbol to help with his networking. He did an interview in the Financial Times. Yeah. It was quite interesting the other day. And coincidentally, the same Lim who happens to be a business partner of current football fans champion Gary Neville.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a timely question, not just because of the fact that Lim did that interview in the Financial Times, but I think that the whole context of the debate around the Super League actually plays into this a little bit. Now, obviously, look, Valencia weren't one of the teams invited to the Super League. Had it been 15 years ago, they absolutely would have been, but they weren't this time around. Lim wasn't involved, and Valencia as a club have come out against it publicly, as all the clubs that weren't involved did. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, I just wonder if we're against this, in brackets, in case they give us a call. look, the interview with the Financial Times was very interesting because it was inadvertently incredibly truthful, very blunt in places. In other places, there was a little bit of lip service, but in a way, I must admit, I read it and thought, well, this is Peter Lim just saying all the things that most owners only think, but he's actually saying it publicly. Some of it did come across as startlingly cynical, startlingly honest in a way that you think this isn't even wise, even for your own sake. You know, for your own sake, at least pretend that you're in this for the fans. Obviously, the context of this as well is that they sacked their manager last week. They sacked Javi Gracia. The reason they hadn't sacked Javi Gracia previously is because it would have cost them, I think it was €3 million to do so. And so they kept with him all season, because they didn't want to pay the payoff. And he kept with them all season because he didn't want to waive the payoff. And they reached a point where they thought, bloody hell, we might actually go down. So eventually sacked him anyway. They put Vodo in charge. Vodo is the caretaker coach. He's now in his 7th spell as manager of Valencia. He comes in, rescues them, and then gets pushed aside again every single time. I wonder at which point he says, no, sod off, I'm not doing this. Anyway, they won at the weekend, but there were these protests. And I think these protests come in the context of the Super League thing, because I think that was a demonstration that fans' voices can be heard and can force things. They also come in the context of something which I think is possibly even more important, which is that underlying this, there is a move towards a tangible attempt to grasp some power at the club, which is to try and gather together enough small shareholders rather, to have enough of a say to be allowed on in the AGMs and so on, so they have a voice. Now, obviously, look, the bottom line is ownership, and there's only so much you can do, but to try and make that move and to try and put pressure on him. And then, as you say, to bring it to Gary Neville, this is Peter Lim, who is a shareholder at Gary Neville's club at Salford, and of course is the owner that put Gary Neville in charge of Valencia. And with the greatest respect to Gary Neville, that even at the time was a slightly bizarre decision. You know, a guy who had no managerial experience, who I think we all thought was very bright, understood football very well, potentially could be a very good coach, but went into a very, very difficult scenario. And Valencia Valencia in terms of the team are in good hands now with Vodo. In terms of the club, I think it's a very different issue.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we will do Serie A. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nicky, Serie A, first of all, we haven't really congratulated Inter. I'm sure Inter have probably celebrated without the official congratulations from Football Weekly. But could you pass on, from us, could you pass on congratulations? You know, two defeats all season. Conte's done an amazing job, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about the celebrations. It was funny because they did actually win the Scudetto in the Italian lexicon. Sul divano, on the sofa, because the weekend before, they obviously had won against Crotone, but it was only after Atalanta drew with Sassuolo that they officially had the title. And actually, I thought some of those scenes were sort of really sweet. And in particular, Romelu Lukaku, who first sort of shared a video of himself, I think pretty much sul divano, on his sofa, pointing out the window, singing songs. And then a few hours later, these videos start to pop up of him in the middle of Milan. He's gone out in his car and he's standing out of the sunroof and he's singing campiones, campione. And there's people in the streets that recognize him. And this exchange, someone goes, oh, sei un dio, you're a god. And he goes, thanks, bro. And it's like, it's such a, honestly, I think of all the scenes in this sort of title celebration, that one really connected, because I think when you consider Lukaku's career and how good of a footballer he is, he hasn't had that moment until now. He hasn't won a title, really. He won the FA Cup at Chelsea, as in he was part of the squad, but I don't think he even played in the final in 2012. So I think there have been these sort of very COVID-specific moments of joy that have unfolded. And then this weekend, just gone, they got to go to San Siro, play a home game, still with no crowd, of course, but you had a big crowd of, I think they estimated about 3,000 people. I think it might have been more, outside San Siro, and the ultras were sort of leading them into the stadium on the streets with flares. And there was a bit more sense of that celebration to it this weekend. But it's been, as you say, such an Antonio Conte win in the end. And if you wanted to be cynical about that, you could say it's a pure Antonio Conte win because they went out of Europe at the beginning of the season and therefore didn't have any extra games to deal with down the stretch. But they have flattened everyone since January. I think in the last 19 games, they've drawn three times. They've won every other game besides that. And yes, Juventus have dropped away. Milan have dropped away. But Inter have just kept on winning. They've become that Antonio Conte very often 1-0 machine where they just grind and grind and grind. And it's really impressive because, as well as anything, and I've talked about it on this podcast before, that is not Inter's identity. It might be Antonio Conte's identity, but Inter were always Pazza Inter, the team that find a way to make things complicated. And in the last part of this run, the last 4 months, really, they haven't made anything complicated at all. They've just been very, very consistent.
I really hope there are other videos of Lukaku standing out of his sunroof cheering around people that just don't really follow football. You know, he must have got in his car, got his garage. Where do I drive to? I'll drive to this street. I'm singing there. Some people just going, who's this man? Just right, yelling.
I mean, you know, Lombardy has been in this red zone for COVID. So actually, it's really not like, other than, you know, basically people just started breaking the rules after they won the league. But besides that, people haven't been gathering in groups. So yes, he must have just got in his car and been like, just going to go looking for people.
And what happens if he drives down an AC Milan street and, you know, they start tracking eggs at him?
It's the risk you take.
It's the risk you take, yeah.
And look, I mean, can you see this being a sort of a period of, you know, the first question after someone wins a title is you can't enjoy it. You just have to go, is this a period of domination now for Inter?
Well, it is the question people are asking already. And there's a good reason they're asking it, which is that, like, lots of other clubs in Europe, to be fair, but Inter have got some serious financial questions hanging over them. And the club obviously has been hit by the pandemic like all football clubs, but so have their owners Suning. And there's been this massive, I don't know what the word is, retrenchment maybe amongst Chinese businessmen in general, seemingly encouraged by the government that foreign investment is basically not really what you're supposed to be doing right now. So Stephen Zhang, who's the club's president and the representative of the Suning family who's involved with the club, has been in Milan this last week or two. And he was there before they won the league. And he went and had this sort of moment with the players where he spoke to them. It was the first time he'd been in Milan for like 7 months. And he's very young. I can't tell you exactly, but he's around 30, young to be a president of a football club. And he's behaves like a genuine fan. In the before times when pre-pandemic, he would go and hang out in sports bars in Milan to watch games. Like, he really used to be very connected to this team. And so after they won the title, he was there too. He was on top of Inter's offices, waving a massive flag like he was an ultra. Like, but since the title's been won, he's had to go and start having these very difficult conversations with everyone. And in the last day, he's been going around these players who've just won the league, just ended an 11-year trophy drought or a title drought for Inter. And he's been asking them, would you mind, because everyone's had their wages delayed, which was allowed and agreed with the federation, would you mind if we just cancel 2 months of your wages so that we can get back on track? And I mean, those conversations are private, but I have a good feeling of how they're going at the moment, which is maybe not actually. So they've talked about having to cut costs at Inter by 15%. I don't really see how you can aim to achieve that without getting rid of some high earners. Now, there are some high earners on that squad who probably are non-essential. If you could get rid of probably Antonio Conte's greatest indulgence, Arturo Vidal, and if you could get rid of Alexis Sanchez, who might also have been an indulgence, but actually has contributed at some important times as well, maybe you'd be making a nice step towards that already, because there's some high earners like that on the books. But these are questions, how you're going to make these savings. They too are seeking investment capital. There's been talk of trying to raise 250 million in investment from somewhere, and Bain Capital has been talked about a lot, but I don't know if that's happened. Well, I do know it hasn't happened yet. I don't know if that's still in the works or not. In the meantime, Antonio Conte has said, let's just celebrate this moment and I'll talk about the future soon. So I think he wants to know what's happening as well. So is it the beginning of something? I think a lot of it depends on how some of these conversations end up going.
Is it going to be one of these moments when Antonio Conte starts to have a go because they're not signing enough players, basically? An old classic.
What's amazing about this story is that you can very much frame this Inter title as partly built on Antonio's success in, once he was told no one's coming in January, knuckling down and actually using what he had, because Christian Eriksen was basically not involved at that point. He started the season trying to use him, tried to play a more attacking brand of football, put him in a number 10 role. It didn't work, and he basically just gave up on him. After January, he brings him back into the team, plays him deeper, has him in this sort of double register type role with Brozovic, where he's a bit of a hybrid, and it works really well. So he salvaged Eriksen because he didn't have an option to not use this Paris squad. Ivan Perisic, likewise, who last season was off winning the Champions League with Bayern Munich, but came back, wasn't really part of Conte's plans, wasn't wanted, but no one else came in. So Conte finally persuades him to play as a wing back, which is kind of what he suggested to him from the beginning. And Perisic becomes this great contributor from wing back. So actually, like, sometimes I think the best thing that can be done with Antonio Conte is to say, you can't have these things. But Conte might not agree with that idea.
Play with that toy you got last Christmas.
Can we talk about Juventus? I mean, there's so much going on at Juventus. A, you know, they're in real danger of not getting into the top four. They're outside of it at the moment, a point behind Napoli and 3 points behind Milan and Atalanta. I mean, it's close there between that. It'll be three of those four, we presume, unless Lazio have a game in hand. Possible, right? But it's not guaranteed that Juventus is going to get in the top four. You've also got the situation where the Italian Football Federation president, Gabriele Gravina, says he's ready to kick them out of Serie A because they are sort of clinging on to the ESL. It is a mess, Nikki.
Yeah, it's a huge mess. I mean, I think most people assumed that they were going to win this game against Milan, or at least not lose it, and they would have had the tiebreaker at that point because they did beat Milan 3-1 last time they played. And actually, so John Elkann is the chairman of Exor, which is the family business, the Agnelli family business that owns Juventus, and he was at the game against Milan, sat with Andrea Agnelli, who's his cousin, who's the president of Juventus. And in the sort of Turin newspapers before kickoff, this was all presented as, here's the united front, like everyone sort of coming together. And I couldn't help but think, as Elkann's watching this 3-0 collapse, is that united front starting to crumble? And is this becoming the moment where he looks at this part of the family business as the one who's kind of in charge of the whole shebang and thinks, this isn't going so well, because it's a disaster if they miss out on the Champions League. I mean, this is a club that has done so well in the last 9 years. And whatever else we say about Agnelli, because I think you can make a case he's got a lot wrong recently, he did have a huge responsibility in the building of this empire. The first and most immediate question is, what on earth happens with Ronaldo, this great gamble you've made that on a European level hasn't worked at all, and he's still on your books for another year? I've said it before, I can't imagine a scenario in which Ronaldo at 36 goes to play in the Europa League, but who's going to pay you for him? So does it then just become a question of, you can come to an agreement between you where you both say, look, you get to walk away, we'll kill this contract because someone else will give you another contract, and that way neither of us has to deal with that. That could be a scenario that suits everyone, but even that wouldn't fill the financial hole that the Juventus are looking at, and you'd have to accept the loss on your account for the last year of his value. It's a really, really big mess. And
then there's Pirlo, right? What happens there?
And then there's Andrea Pirlo, who I expect he's gone. The club is digging their heels in for now, and I think that kind of makes sense because you've got 4 games to play now in 2 weeks, because you've got a midweek round. And then you've also got the Coppa Italia squeezed in, because they did reach the final of the Coppa Italia, squeezed in between the next 2 rounds. They've got tough games, by the way, Juventus. I think it's definitely too soon to assume they won't make the top four. I don't think that Napoli, Milan or Atalanta can take the last 3 games for granted. Milan and Atalanta are playing each other for a start. But Juventus's schedule has started to look the toughest on paper, because they have Sassuolo, who are flying at the moment, fighting for Europa League place. And then they have Inter, who, yes, have won the title. But Antonio Conte coming back and having the chance to rub in what he's just done and bringing down their empire. Pirlo's going to stay in charge for these 4 games, because you've got a game every 3 days. There's very little you're likely to achieve by changing it. But I can't imagine he'll be there next season. And I think it would be astonishing if he is, because he walked into a tough situation in a sense. He was no experience at all, and he had a very short summer to prepare. But a year into this project, nothing has improved. They've lost some hugely embarrassing games. 3-0 to Fiorentina, 3-0 to Milan, lost at home to Benevento, who are probably going to get relegated. I don't see how his position could be tenable, and it doesn't feel like anything is progressing in the right way on the pitch.
I have two managerial questions for you, Nicky, before we go to Barry's Bundesliga bulletin. Jose Mourinho at Roma, we obviously talked about it last week. I mean, I was surprised when it happened. You know, already there are, you know, sort of Banksy-like murals of Jose on the walls of Rome. What did you make of it, and what's the reaction been?
I thought it was an amazing piece of PR theatre. No one saw it coming, and I mean really no one saw it coming, and it stole the thunder from Inter's titles win, which was literally 2 days before. And I think, as I've said already in a couple of places, I think it's going to end very badly. but I could be wrong. I've been wrong about lots of things before. He certainly has a very different reputation, Mourinho, at this point in Italy to what he has in England. Everyone still has him locked in mind as the Inter Mourinho, the one who won the treble, the one who was all conquering. And maybe he'll be able to start over. But again, the project he's walking into there is very much a we kind of need to start over. We've got a nice core of young Italian players, some really good young Italian players at Roma. But
to ruin.
But then you've got Edin Dzeko at 36 is basically the only real striker in your squad. So probably needs to like make some fresh ideas about how to actually attack. And where's the money coming from? Because you've got a bunch of players in your squad like Javier Pastore who are just sitting there absorbing big chunks of the wage bill without doing anything. So it's a really not a straightforward team. There's talk of a long-term project and it's not about winning now. And you think, well, when did Mourinho last do that? And Rome is so intense. I was thinking when Sid was talking about the VAR moment before with Sevilla and Madrid, Rome is one of those places where if you go and sit in the press box, whether it's a Lazio game or a Roma game, some of the journalists will literally have like scarves on their bench showing their allegiance. It's not subtle. And the intensity of the media environment there has burned some much more reserved managers than Mourinho. I can't imagine that relationship is going to be calm. And again, who knows? Maybe he can translate that into this siege atmosphere that he does so well and the squad will rise to it and it'll be amazing. But the scenario I have in my mind is something that could quickly become much more toxic than that and could go really sour for them.
And obviously Jose, his didn't all go swimmingly well at his last club. And the current favourite to take over at Spurs is Simone Inzaghi. Can you see that happening? And if it does, what would Spurs be getting?
Yeah, I think Inzaghi is ready for another opportunity. I think he's done a good job at Lazio. Lazio are not a team that was accustomed to qualifying for the Champions League. He got them in. I think he's someone who has done a really good job of building a team around what he had. Ciro Immobile had come off this indifferent period in his career and comes back to Rome and Inzaghi goes, well, what is Immobile good at? Because he is a limited, really good goal scorer. He's a really good goal scorer, but you put him in a team that requires him to play outside of his comfort zone, and I think he very quickly becomes ineffective. But he's a great counter-attacking player. He's got the pace, he's got the instinct to play on the shoulder of the defender and get in behind them. So you made this quick strike team and you built everything around getting the maximum value out of this asset you had. And I'd be fascinated to see him do that in a different context like Tottenham. I think he would be receptive to it. I think the money would be better. I think the opportunity to take a break from working from Claudio Lotito would appeal to most people. And I think it could happen in that sense. Whether or not Tottenham's interest is serious, that's not a question I can answer.
All right. Barry does Germany. God, that sounds like an erotic.
Quite an ambitious project.
Max, after what you've said about, I think Big Sam's bear backing in the Caribbean, you've got to be careful about your references.
Barry, tell us everything.
Well, Nicky said that Inter won the Serie A title, sul divano, on the sofa, and Bayern Munich did something similar with the Bundesliga. They didn't win it on the sofa, but they won it on the short walk between their team bus and the dressing room at the Allianz Arena, because when they were going to play Borussia Mönchengladbach, Borussia Dortmund and RB Leipzig were playing in an earlier kickoff, and RB Leipzig were the only team who could theoretically and mathematically catch Bayern. But a late Jadon Sancho winner for Borussia Dortmund in a 3-2 win ensured that Bayern won the title. They celebrated in fine style, going on to beat Mönchengladbach 6-0. And Robert Lewandowski scored a hat-trick, which brings him to 39 Bundesliga goals for the season, one off the record held by Gerd Müller from the 1971-72 season. So he has two games left to break that record or equal it, and equal or break it. And his teammates are doing everything in their power to ensure that he does that. So that means that Hansi Flick leaves Bayern now with seven titles. Julian Nagelsmann will take over from him. And the Dortmund-RB Leipzig game was a dress rehearsal for the German Cup final, which is on this Thursday night. So with two rounds of fixtures left for most fixtures, Schalke are relegated and just 2 points separate Cologne, Armenia, B- Bielefeld, Werder Bremen and Hertha Berlin for the second automatic relegation spot. And the top of the table, Bayern are champions, obviously. RB Leipzig, Wolfsburg are in the box seats for Champions League qualification. And then Borussia Dortmund are in fourth spot with and they're a point ahead of Eintracht Frankfurt. So their qualification for the Champions League is by no means assured yet. And sad news in Cologne, where Hennes VIII, their club mascot, a goat, a proper sort of regimental type goat, Billy Goat with the big horns. He was their mascot from 2008 to 2019, and he had to retire in 2019 due to ill health. And a couple of weeks ago, he had to be put down. So that was quite sad for Cologne fans. He was very popular with them. He lives in Cologne Zoo and used to be transported to the ground for all the home games, where he would stand on the sideline, and his entrance to the stadium was a very sort of popular affair. And he was Hennes VIII, one of a long line of Hennes's the goats.
How many wives did Hennes VIII have?
In 1950, a local circus gifted Cologne a goat, and he was named Hennes after Hennes Wieswieler, who was the player manager at the time and something of a club legend. So as each Hennes shuffles off this mortal coil, he's replaced. So they're up to Hennes the ninth now, but he obviously isn't allowed to attend games at the moment because of COVID regulations.
Okay. And they have official regulations for goats, I presume. Can a goat get COVID?
Well, I would imagine it's more the goat handler than right. The goat.
So if Hennes the Ninth could make his own way, then he could,
he'd probably be fine.
Help supporting Cologne in their bid to stay in the Bundesliga. But
Hennes the Eighth famously did escape from his handler on one occasion and ran amok out on the pitch during half time of a game.
Brilliant. Thank you, Barry. I enjoyed that tremendously.
You're welcome.
And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with Ligue 1. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ligue 1, Philippe. Over the weekend, Lille won the Derby du Nord.
Yeah.
3-0 at Lens.
At a canter.
At a canter, didn't they? PSG could only get a point in a draw with Rennes.
And they were lucky.
They were lucky as well. Mm. And, they got angry at the end, like they
as usual.
Have done recently. So Lille only need 4 points from their remaining two games, Bordeaux and Monaco. Give us an idea of the context, if Lille manage it, how big a deal is that?
It's huge for so many reasons, and it's huge even if PSG basically started the season with a 6-point handicap, because there was no team really for the first two rounds of Ligue 1. Everybody had just played the final of the Champions League, lost it against Bayern Munich. The atmosphere in the camp was not very good. They had no preseason and so forth. So you could say that PSG have played a league campaign over 36, not 38 games. But all the same, what Christophe Galtier has achieved is simply sensational, because yet again, they've lost some of their key players. Obviously, Omisen went to Napoli for a lot of money. They got Jonathan David in, but they as ever, every time they have a good season, and most of their seasons under Galtier are good seasons, they've got to get rid of a few players. I actually calculated the value of the team that won against Lens 3-0 in what was supposed to be really the biggest test for them until the end of the season, and it cost €56 million. All 11 players put together. That's crazy. And as ever, there's been some really inspired recruitment, and not more, of course, than Yilmaz at 35 years of age, who is just phenomenal. Scored an absolute blinder. I mean, what a beauty it was.
It was wonderful. As he sort of cut, it was sort of bad defending, but he ended up with the ball about 35 yards out, and he just put it onto his left foot and hit it perfect into the top left-hand corner. Interestingly, Clive Allen was doing co-coms in the English commentary and sort of said, yeah, the keeper's got to do better than that. And I was like, come on, yeah, Clive. Right. Like, Not for me, Clive, is what I thought. it was a brilliant goal, wasn't it?
It was beautiful.
And has this season come out of nowhere?
Well, no, because, you know, Lille has been a regular contender for Champions League place and has played in the Champions League and has played in the Europa League and, you know, quite regularly against with Christophe Galtier. What I would say is a bit unexpected is that in mid-season, the club changed owners and it was absolute panic. They've lost one of the great architects of their current success, Luis Campos, the famous Luis Campos, who was a scout for Real Madrid, who was a football director at Monaco, and then was a football director at Lille, and has left because the owner, Gérard Lopez, a character about whom I'm not going to say too much in this pod, was literally forced to sell the club. And they've been bought in December by a very, very opaque investment fund. Very, very opaque indeed, based in Luxembourg with antennas a little bit everywhere. It's crazy. And the club financially is doing very badly. They've still got over 100 million euros of debt, despite making so much money on player sales, which has led many people to wonder, where did the money actually go? Well, maybe one day we'll find out. But despite all that, Christophe Galtier yet again has done it. And I think there won't be a single person, I think, in France who would not rejoice. I mean, of course, PSG fans would be disappointed, but I think everybody is rooting for Galtier and his team you've got such a mix. You know, José Fonte, you remember him?
Yeah, it was lovely to see José Fonte celebrate. I was like, oh, that's where he is.
They're 37 years of age. And they just have this knack. I mean, Jonathan David looks like a player who is going to be an absolute star. And they got it again from Ghent at a relatively low price. They've also found a new... they're getting all these players from Turkey at the moment, which is the kind of... Usually people go to Turkey, end of career. And Lille have thought, well, actually, no, they've got some really good players there, including Yilmaz, who has got some just phenomenal stats I think he's had 15 goals in 26 games. And he's better than he's ever been. And by the way, he's better than he's ever been for the national team as well. He scored a hat-trick against the Netherlands in the World Club qualifier. He's flying. And that this should happen when the club is going through such a turmoil. Shows you why Christophe Galtier, he was twice French Manager of the Year. He will be French Manager of the Year again. And why so many people, should start to become really interested in him, even though he's only managed two clubs in his whole career, Saint-Étienne and Lille, and he's now 54, and which is a surprise to me. There's no doubt for me he's the best manager of his generation in France. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
What's the what's the sort of PSG chat then? You know, Pochettino might end up in the semi-final of the Coupe de France, but it might end up winning nothing. Oh, he did win something in like his second game or something. Didn't
Well, the Trophée des Champions is like the community shield. Right. So that doesn't count. And yes, and because they've got a tricky game, tricky semi-final. And also, when you see the way they played against Rennes, that was abysmal. They were missing Marco Verratti big time. But and Kylian Mbappé, of course, was still suffering from this muscular problem. But even then, against the Rennes team, which, you know, is limited, has had its problems as well this season, they showed absolutely nothing. And and they deserve to lose, to be honest, rather than take a point. And again, they lost their temper with Presnel Kimpembe going for an absolute mad tackle at the very end of the game. I mean, he just can't cope with defeat. And you could see that Pochettino was looking at it and he was going, what can I do? And I think this is the question most people are asking. You know why? You know who might actually help Pochettino is Thomas Tuchel. Because Thomas Tuchel is doing so well with Chelsea that people in France are starting to think, hold on a minute. The problems we have, maybe it's not our managers. Actually, you managed to sack Carlo Ancelotti the year before he won the Champions League, right? You've managed to sack Thomas Tuchel after he took you to the final of Champions League. Look where he is now. And you've just got Mauricio Pochettino. So maybe calm down a little bit for once. And we'll see. It's not great. Atmosphere at Paris. I don't know if you saw the picture of Neymar's extending his contract. If I were you, I honestly, all of you, have a look. Go on Google, Bing, or DuckDuckGo, and search for Neymar signing new contract. It's amazing. It's like, to be honest, somebody's been just been killed or is about to be killed in that room. They're all wearing dark suits. And they are not smiling. It's the least you can say. But he's extended his deal.
Given the fact that PSG have not won the league and didn't progress in the Champions League, is Neymar renewing a surprise? And the fact that, as you say in the photos, no one looks particularly happy about it.
I think they absolutely needed to do something, an announcement quickly. They're also very concerned about the future of Kylian Mbappé.
But but why would Neymar accept this? If he, I mean, there's a bit of me that, and forgive me, people who love French football. There's a bit of me that thinks, what on earth is Neymar doing, tying himself to this?
Who at the moment would be prepared to offer Neymar kind of conditions? The Neymar we have now at his age, he's not a young, promising buck any longer. But who would be prepared to give him the same conditions? Who has the money?
Well, Barcelona were trying, but don't have the money. I mean, that's exactly.
They don't have the money. They've got 1.2 billion in debt and they lost 100 million euros last year. So he's not going to go to Real Madrid, is he?
You make it sound like, you know, one of those things where Neymar thinks he's signing an autograph and then they unfold a 3-year contract. He's like, you got me, guys. Oh, well.
Unlucky chance.
Such is life. Anyway, just a couple of emails to finish off the pod today. Oh, no, Fabio Whitaker's been in touch to say, it's a very special request. 2 years ago, my team, Sao Paulo, bought a one-season wonder striker named Pablo for 8 million euros. After 2 years, he can't score, he can't assist, he can't do anything. Barry, would you please criticise him? This is my last hope.
Yeah, I think it's about time Pablo got his finger out and justified his huge fee, but I don't see any hope for him.
Perfect. Let us know how that goes, Fabio, please. Here's an email, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Dear Max and everyone, can you please stop talking about people crashing their cars on the podcast? I'm always driving while listening, and it fills me with an enormous sense of impending doom. While you were recounting people's various vehicular mishaps on Monday's pod, a caravan going in the opposite direction snaked into my path and I had to mount the verge to escape. I'm a newly qualified teacher placed in a school 96 miles from my home. And your football-based musings are a delight in my commute. Please stop foreshadowing my demise. Kind regards, Martin, a Celtic fan. Glad of the Fitbar Corner neglect this season, at least, he says. And Aladdin Newport says, hi, Max and Barry and everyone else. I've had a car crash while listening to the football ramble. Hope that helps even things out. one more, Will, who said, I was enjoying the pod on a flight from Philly to Dallas. I decided to skip the last bit as I got a tad worried. We then diverted to Arkansas due to weather at our destination. I'm currently sat on the tarmac while the pilot makes a couple of calls. Yeah, maybe we should end this feature before it ends in a way that would be really like... bad. So yeah, thanks so much for everyone letting us know, but yeah, we finished the car crash section of Football Weekly now, unless you think all of it is a car crash, of course, in a different way. Thanks so much for your time. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Sid.
Very much a pleasure. Cheerio.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Cheers, Baz.
Cheers.
Lots of Premier League happening in the next couple of days, and we'll be back to talk about that on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.